All right, ladies and gentlemen, good morning to you. This is your host, Selwyn Robbins, for the Mandated Podcast. And as always, I'm excited about every opportunity I have to bring a guest on the show so that we can really explore the topics that we have here on Mandated, which can be just about anything that a man is involved in. And today, we're going to get into a subject that I told you this particular show is not for the faint of heart, in a way. You know, we talk about serious subjects, and this one is definitely on that vein. But first, before we get into that subject, I want to introduce you to our guest today, the young man that you see and hear. His name is Emiliano De Leon. Diaz De Leon, correct?
Diaz De Leon, yeah.
All right. Buenos dias, hermano. Good to see you, dude.
Buenos dias.
Just to give you a little bit of his background, he has been an advocate for several domestic and violence centers across Texas. He's now working with TASA, which is the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault, and specifically as the Men's Engagement Specialist. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Emiliano Diaz De Leon. What's going on, man?
It's good, man. I'm so happy to be with you this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to come on your podcast. I've been tuning in and listening for a while. So, it is a real honor to be with you this morning.
Oh, man. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. I always appreciate that. You know, I want to make sure people are getting something that is definitely information to them, and they want to return and hear some more. And yes, that's what we're going to do today. And you're going to be a part of it. So, you know, as I spoke to you at pre-show, you know, one thing I always want to speak about before anything else is family, because I just love family. So, you know, tell our listeners about yourself and your family. You know, what's new with you guys, and what are you looking to do?
Well, thank you. That's a great way to begin. Well, like I said, my name is Emiliano Diaz de Leon. I am the men's engagement specialist with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. And, you know, I'm a husband and a father of a 12-year-old boy. I've been married to my partner, Cynthia, for in February of next year, it'll be 20 years.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, it's an exciting milestone for us. So we've been together pretty much, you know, half of my life. me and Cynthia started dating when I had just turned 21. Uh-huh. And that's about the time when I started to do this work, you know. So we met around that time where I was transitioning from working as a youth minister. And it's actually the way that I met Cynthia. We met at a local Catholic community center. Mm-hmm. And she was volunteering, I was volunteering with young people, and we started dating soon after. And you know, the rest is history, and you know, we're very blessed to have a little boy, Joaquin, who is going to be 12 this month, and is going into the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And so Cynthia is a longtime educator. She works as an instructional coach at a local school here in Leander, Texas, and Joaquin goes to, you know, a local middle school. So, and I'm very fortunate, you know, like you said, to be with TASA, to have been working with TASA for the last 13 years. And so, yeah, that's just we live here in Cedar Park, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I love my family. My family comes first, and I think that's really been the primary. My son and my partner have been the primary motivation for me to do this work. And so, I really credit them for their support, because, you know, Cynthia was the one who encouraged me to do this work. You know, really? And so I started as a result of her encouragement. I started as a volunteer, and then was hired as a children's advocate at the local shelter here in Austin for battered women. And so that's where I got, you know, that's how I got my start. So most folks who are victim advocates, who are, you know, who have been doing this work, who this is their, you know, this is my life's work. Mm-hmm. You know, got started that way. Started yeah. as volunteers, and then were eventually hired at their local center, local domestic violence or rape crisis center. And so, yeah, that's how I came to the work. More importantly, I think for folks, you know, if you Google me, you can read a little bit about my story. But mm-hmm. I'm also a survivor of family mm-hmm. violence, okay. and that's why this work has been so. Mm-hmm. So important to me. I mean, again, you know, I came to the work as a survivor, also as somebody who perpetrated teen dating violence when I was a young man. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, was really active in an intervention program in my high school here in Austin that, you know, changed my entire life, mm-hmm. you know, that ultimately set me on this path that I'm still on. So, you know, that, it, you know, there are a lot of folks who have similar stories, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of especially men who are doing this work, you know, come to this work as survivors themselves. And so, yeah. You know, I'm just, like I said, blessed mm-hmm. to be with you this morning and to be able to talk about the work that I do and sort of my journey mm-hmm. that I'm on. So, yeah. That's just a little bit about me.
But you know, that's an awesome story. Really is. I love how you met Cynthia. You know, she it's always good to meet them, you know, when you meet the person you don't know for sure at the time, you know, if that's going to be the one in your life for a long time. You've been married for going on 20 years. And that is so awesome that you were, of course, you know, the initial engagement, but to continue engaging as a husband with Cynthia and, of course, Joaquin. Mm-hmm. You know, in that marriage, before we even get into the topic, let's talk about marriage real quick. What is the one thing as a husband you see that really is required? You know, outside of we know love, we know the compassion, we know the presence, but what's one thing that sticks out to you as a husband that you know is very necessary to continue the longevity in your marriage?
You know, it's one of those things that I still have to work on, you know, mm-hmm. Communication. You know, I didn't mm-hmm. have, you know, because I witnessed, you know, family violence, mm-hmm. I didn't know what healthy communication looked like. I didn't know what a healthy mm-hmm. relationship looked like, a healthy nonviolent relationship looked like. Yeah. I had no idea what that looked like. So I didn't learn those lessons. Until I met Cynthia, right? Mm-hmm. And because even up to that point, I was still being emotionally abusive, verbally abusive in my relationships prior to meeting Cynthia. Mm-hmm. So I was still struggling even mm-hmm. with my own abusive behavior. And it was most of the time around communication, just being honest and vulnerable, and being clear about what my needs or listening to their needs or just communication period, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. And so it's one of those things that you know, after dating Cynthia and then being engaged for a long time with her before we got married, mm-hmm. it was work that I was having to put in. Cynthia had those skills. She came from a very she came from a beautiful family that was the completely opposite of mine, right? Mm. Like, it was a middle class. I grew up in the barrio. I grew up really mm-hmm. you know, in poverty, around drugs and alcohol, around gang violence, etc., right? Like, that was growing up here in Austin on the east side. You know, I witnessed and experienced everything, right? Like, I think in my neighborhood and at home. And so all of that had, you know, a profound impact on me and my ability to communicate nonviolently, mm-hmm. right? And just communicate, yeah. like, to be, to listen for mm-hmm. understanding and,
yeah.
To communicate my needs, et cetera. You know, I just, like, So communication is something I'm still working on. Like mm-hmm. I'm still trying to figure out, like, I'm not always the best communicator mm-hmm. with Cynthia or with Joaquin. Mm-hmm. And because again, it's one of those lessons I never learned. So I'm learning from trial and error in terms of mm-hmm. like from practice. And I'm trying to grow and allow myself to be more vulnerable, to mm-hmm. express my emotions more, to be present, to listen. These are all things that I have that I think is going to be lifelong work for me. And so because of all the trauma, the abuse mm-hmm. that I witnessed and experienced firsthand, you know, so I think mm-hmm. I think as an adult, you know, as I've gotten older, I understand how, like, as a result of this work, I understand how trauma impacts our entire life, our relationships, etc. And mm-hmm. so yeah, man, it's been hard, but I think it's also I've learned a lot from both of them, you know, at the mm-hmm. same time, because they have skills. My son, you know, I talk a lot about how he, as an 11-year-old boy, is like way advanced than where I was at 11 years old, mm-hmm. right? In terms of his lived experience and his development and his intelligence, et cetera. Like, just I've learned so much from him, and I've learned so much from my partner, Cynthia. She's just an amazing wife, an amazing mother. You know, so I think I've learned a lot from her in terms of communication and parenting. Again, she had a whole family, you know, she mm-hmm. had a mother and dad in her life. I was raised by a single mom, you know, and there were men that came in and out of my life who were abusive, and mm-hmm. I didn't have my dad, you know, growing up. So, you know, just like for a lot of men who are watching, I think probably or listening, that resonates with you, right? So yeah. I think, unfortunately it's too common, right? But I think part mm-hmm. of my life's work is to break that cycle. So I've broken mm-hmm. that cycle, yeah. right? Like, I'm mm-hmm. in my son's life.
Yep.
You know, I'm with my partner, we're in this nonviolent loving relationship. And I think that ultimately my son will continue to build mm-hmm. on these foundations that we're creating for him. So I can only imagine the kind of man he's going to be, or the kind of relationships that he's going to have, or the kind of father, if he wants to be a dad. You know, just, he's already such an amazing young man. You know, so I'm just excited that I get to contribute to that. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Again, it really is a blessing to be able to, like, contribute to and to be able to witness and to experience the development of this boy becoming a young man. So you know, this is a really exciting moment in my life, you know. It's a life, like, for life for me, just like, you know, with just waking up this morning, being on this podcast with you, like, just living, you know, just living life is a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. Especially coming from the place where I came from,
right,
being alive and is a big deal. Surviving that is a big deal for me, you know, like, and I know for a lot of folks, they might not understand that, but I think without those early interventions, without Cynthia, I don't know where I would be. You know, I don't even know if I would be alive, man, to be honest.
You know, you said you pointed out a great couple of things in there that really tie into where we're going to go in today's topic. And for those that are listening, I'm speaking with Emiliano Diaz de Leon from TASA, the men's engagement specialist. And we were just speaking about family and that one thing within marriage, that really stands out to him. And he mentioned communication. And for men, communication is a big deal because there's a lack of it, especially when it comes to emotions. And it's so interesting you mentioned communication, because this morning I was editing some information that I was writing, and I remembered at a time where I used to be abusive in a previous relationship. And one thing I had recognized was that, and in a sense, a metaphorical way, is that it's like a lion trapped in a corner. He could do all the roaring he wants, but he can't get out. And the only way for him to get out is for him to fight, in a way. So that's where that abuse comes in, that lack of communication. Had we been trained or had a person close to us that can exemplify communication, we would have been able to come out of that corner, not fighting, but talking. And in the subsequent of it, you know, people being healed and emotions being dealt with. And that's a big thing when it comes to men, is that we don't deal with the emotions properly. And when that happens, of course, there's a downfall in many areas of our life. So with that, let's get into today's topic, and that's about sexual assault. And I want to come from two sides of this, because in your background, you used to work directly with the victim. So let's talk about that first. In the 10 plus years that you were on that side of the coin, let's speak about your emotions. How did you navigate sitting in front of a victim and trying to help them through?
For sharing, you know, sharing a little bit about your experience. Like I thought,
it's hard.
I just wanted to validate that because, again, it's real, you know, for a lot of us who are listening and watching. You know, we usually, most of us know or love someone who's experienced some form of physical or sexual violence or abuse. You know, that's an unfortunate reality. For me, it was, you know, it was, to be honest, at the beginning, it was very scary, right? Being the only, I was the first and only male advocate in the shelter at the time. And that was a risk on their part. So if you go and talk to my colleagues at Safe Alliance here in Austin, they will tell you that they took a considerable risk in hiring me, because of the way that we think about men and the way that we think about men of color in particular, in terms of, you know, violence and abuse towards women and children. I think that association, those stereotypes of being aggressive or being violent or abusive, they were there. They weren't true for me, right? Like, they were no longer true for me as somebody who was working as a victim advocate. But that's, unfortunately, that's how people in the world sometimes see us. And so I had to really practice, like I had to model, like on a daily basis. Like I had to be, you know, my mentor, Melinda Cantu, who's still with Safe Alliance, used to remind me that you had to be on all the time, right? You had to be aware and conscious that the women and children who were living in the shelter were constantly watching you. They were looking for you to overstep, like to overstep your boundaries, or to say or do something abusive, or to be inappropriate with them, you know, with the women, with them as like women, or with their children, right?
Right.
And so I was very, very aware of that, like all the time. You know, I was with Safe. I worked as a children's advocate for 7 years in that shelter, and so I was constantly aware of the impact that I was having on everybody, not just the women and children who had left abusive situations, right? Who had left men who looked like me, right? For the most part, right? So these were a lot of women of color who didn't have any other resource but or they had no other way to leave the abusive situation but then to come to shelter. They didn't have the same sort of network, the same kind of resources that other privileged women had. So we served a lot of women and children of color. And so I was very conscious as a man of color, like, you know, what that meant. And so I tried to be vulnerable. I tried to practice both vulnerability and understanding, like, as much as I could, and of who they were, right? Empathy.
Yeah.
That's the word I was thinking of. Like practicing empathy, right? And it was that to me is a practice, right? It's something that you have to learn, and you have to be given permission to practice. And so they gave me permission. The women that I worked with really showed me how and taught me everything that I know about victim advocacy. And so and it's about how I communicated with the women and the children, the moms and the children in that shelter on a daily basis, and just allowing them to see me with their kids, right? To being able to witness what it could look like, how it could be different, right? What a healthy man looks like and acts like and talks like and walks like.
Yeah.
Right. And so you know, I was pretty young. You know, I was in my early 20s. I was 21 when I started working there. I was working with young people of all ages, from infants all the way to teenagers. And so I just really, you know, that's where I really learned how to be a parent and a father, right? Because that was way before, you know, I became a parent or father. So that taught me a lot of really important lessons about just being myself, and that it was okay to be myself, and it was okay to be, I didn't have to be, something I wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, and I wanted the boys, especially the boys there, to be able to see that, to witness a man express his feelings and to speak non, you know, to communicate, to be patient and speak nonviolently. And so I was really always aware of my language and always aware, you know, I get down on, you know, to at their level, and you know what I mean? So it really, as a man, I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to respect people's boundaries. I wanted to ask for permission before I touched, you know, children, or, you know, wanted to make sure that people were comfortable talking to me, you know, one-on-one, you know, would you prefer, you know, my coworker being with us so we can talk about your child. So it was just like a lot of really important lessons about boundaries, about consent, about communication, you know, and then support, like just boundless support, unconditional support, and genuine love and care for the women and children that were in the shelter, you know. And I think ultimately I had to, my heart, you know, like I felt like I was the Grinch. Just, you know, how the Grinch had this small heart and then it grew bigger over time. Like I felt like, you know, my heart grew, heart grew during that time, because I could see, I could empathize with the children and the moms, because I could see my mom and I could see myself and my siblings, my three siblings, and the children that I worked with every day.
Yeah.
And I think that wasn't true for victim advocates, you know, like most folks that had been in that position before didn't have that lived experience. And so for me, that's what really informed, like, what would I, like, if I'm leaving my home because of violence and abuse, what kind of place would I want to go?
Yeah.
What kind of people would I want to be around? Mm-hmm. And so my goal was to create that safety and that space for children to be children, you know, to be loved and cared for, not just by their, like their parents, right? And give the space for their moms to be parents and to be moms and to heal, but also a space for them to heal, you know, from what they witnessed, because I never had that space when I was a kid. You know, it just, to be real, it just was, my mother never went into a shelter. There were a lot of opportunities where she would have, it would have been best for her and for us to go into a shelter. Mm-hmm. And she just never did it. Just out of pride and conviction, she was not going to, she wasn't going to do it.
Oh, so, let me ask this, you know, as you're being that victim advocate, you can imagine the weight that that mother or that child, or even that young, that man or whatnot, the weight of trauma that they're dealing with and not knowing how to process that. Because we know that for the most part, and I'm looking at stats real quick, it says about 91% of sexual assault victims don't report. So knowing that they're coming to a place of advocacy, a safe haven, what is a refuge city, what or place, I'll say, what kind of traumas are they dealing with that you see that they're dealing with and you're, as you're speaking with them and trying to engage?
Yeah, a lot of, they're just an immediate, and that's still true today. So none of this has changed, unfortunately. This is still true for a lot of women and children who come into shelter, and men too, because now, you know, here it's safe here in Austin, and some shelters, some centers around the state, they offer shelter for men, either single men, men without children, and men with kids. So it's true for them as well. But they are an immediate crisis, right? They've left everything. Sometimes the only thing that they come to the shelter with are the clothes on their back. And so it's addressing sort of their immediate needs, right? About just providing a safe place to be and to sleep and to bathe and to have clothes and to have toys and books. So once we, once most victim advocates can address those basic human needs that we all have, then we can begin to, you know, they will begin to address the emotional, the emotional issues that are the trauma from the violence or abuse that they've experienced and that they've witnessed. Right. And so, and it's a very, you know, most families stay anywhere between 30 to some centers allow families to stay up to 90 days. So during that time, they're getting, they're working with a caseworker to figure out childcare, employment, housing, transportation, all the things that we need to be functioning, like to be able to function and to eventually for that woman and her children to leave, to be able to leave the shelter and be successful and safe, right? So whether it's a making sure that they have a protective order if they need it, making sure that their children are getting the therapy that they need, the medical care that they need. So a lot of shelters provide all of that. They provide childcare. They provide schooling for the kids. They have some centers have clinics on site, doctors and nurses on site, so that children, you know, are getting their basic, again, human needs met. But in addition to that, they're also getting counseling, their support group, support groups, not just for the women, but also for the children. And so that's what I did, is I provided a lot of therapeutic services to kids, even though I was not a counselor. I was, you know, I'm a social worker by trade. And so a lot of my work has been providing support, creating support groups for children, creating activities where children can explore their experiences and be with other children in a safe environment and begin to unpack the trauma that they've experienced. And that takes, that's a lifetime of work. right? So yeah. That's why I was saying earlier is that I'm still on this journey. I'm still trying to, I'm still healing from the violence and abuse that I witnessed and experienced when I was a boy. It's like a nightmare that never ends, to be honest.
Wow.
You know, unfortunately, you know, for a lot of adult survivors of family violence and sexual assault, that's what it feels like. That's the most descriptive way that I can describe that trauma, you know, is that you're constantly, you know, trauma is a funny thing, right? Because it's in our bodies.
That it is.
It's just there in our bones. You know, it's like it's one of those things that I still fear for. Even though my mom ended her last abusive relationship right before I started doing this work, or actually a little bit after I started doing this work, she ended her last abusive relationship. But that fear, that concern for my mother, has never left me.
Right.
To be honest, you know, she's retired. She's living her life. You know, she's no longer in abusive relationships.
Right.
But I still worry about her safety.
You know, in that, you know, there's an imprint that's left, or residue that we still deal with because of it. And, you know, honestly, I don't know that you can get rid of that. You can heal for sure from it. But I think because of that image that's still there, it allows you to become stronger, be able to know your own boundaries, and hopefully help someone else recognize boundaries and set those boundaries just as well. I remember as a kid, you know, I don't know, maybe elementary or junior high, they taught us about that safe zone around us, that circle that you don't let anybody in. And we still use that scenario in our life today. Now, unfortunately, some of those lines have definitely been crossed, and, you know, needless to say, abuse is the result of it. But we still operate in that. And when anybody, I would say, goes through that, any form of abuse, they start to extend that circle. And, you know, okay, obviously this line or this circle wasn't wide enough, so let me cast that out a little further, because it's all about self-preservation at that time. And I'm sure, you know, your mom, as she has survived and moved on to a better life, she, you know, we all do have triggers. You know, there's something that may remind us of what that past is, but leaving it just as that is just a trigger, and it doesn't take us back to living that life at all. So now let's transition over. As you were advocating, now you've moved into the role of partnering with organizations that work as the advocates. What's the viewpoint from that side now on partnering?
Yeah, that is it has been an interesting experience, right? You know, because like I said, I was a victim advocate even right before I came to TASA. So like that was the job that I transitioned from into TASA. That really has informed my work, right? Like everything I do in terms of all the training and support that I offer to individual folks who are doing prevention education, folks who are working with victims and survivors, everything I say and do has been informed by that lived experience. I think folks really appreciate the fact that that I also came from that place that they're currently in. So I know what it's, I have that lived experience of being a victim advocate, of wearing multiple hats at an agency as a, you know, I've only worked professionally at nonprofits. So I have that, you know, like that nonprofit life, you know, it's just my life. I don't know, I've never worked for a corporation. I've never worked for any kind of other institution. I only know nonprofits. I only know domestic violence and rape crisis centers, right? And so I think that that really speaks to folks. It makes them really comfortable to engage with me because of that lived both my lived experience in terms of being a survivor, as well as my work experience, my professional experience as a victim advocate. And so, but clearly advocacy has also changed in the last decade, right? So I'm also, one of the things that I think is important for folks to is that we're willing to constantly learn, because our, just like for teachers, like my wife, they receive a lot of professional development. So do we, we need to be constantly learning, because what we know about trauma and what we know about healing and about providing victim services is constantly changing. So the way that we provide services is different from the way that we provided, that I provided services back in the day, so I try to keep, part of it is to keep up with sort of the trends in the field of domestic and sexual violence prevention and victim advocacy, right? So a lot of, I spend a lot of time learning from other experts in the field, and then passing on what I've learned to folks, for folks in the field who are doing the work every day, And so without them, those are the folks on the front line answering calls, working with victims and survivors, working with children, working with perpetrators too. Offenders of domestic and sexual violence, right? So I have a lot of appreciation, love for those folks, and it really is a result of being in the trenches, because it feels like a war. It feels like a war because it's never ending. It's just a some of our centers have waiting lists. There's that many women and children and men who are looking for shelter from domestic or sexual violence, right? There's not enough funding for their work, right? They're not getting paid as well as other social service organizations, right? So a lot of volunteers, a lot of organizations, if it wasn't for volunteers, they wouldn't be able to provide just basic minimum services. So I know exactly what that's like, and so I think from my experience, people really appreciate that. They value that. They really people, not that I see myself as this, but I think people really, in essence, you're sort of treated as a guru. People come to you while you're on the hill and they look for advice and they look for guidance. And I'm really honored, I think, as a result of being, in that place to now be able to provide that kind of support. It is really, again, this is my life's work. I can't imagine doing anything else, to be honest, for the rest of my life.
And, I believe that's very key from the perspective of a man. We always need to know, if it's not at that moment, what is it that we're called to, we're drawn to, what we're supposed to be advocating for. And it's great to know that you've been in that role for these many years and continuing to grow in it. It's one thing to bounce from corporate to nonprofit to entrepreneurship, those different hats and whatnot, having the different experiences. But I think there's a great impact when you're working or operating in that vein of the very thing that can build people. And, I'm looking at, some of the stats on there, and all the stats are about, how many have been abused, not reported, who has not been found in regards to the assailant or the victimizer. But I want to turn the tables. I don't want to say turn the tables, turn a corner on this a little bit.
Yeah.
We're speaking on that, but let's speak on the rescue. And celebrate is not necessarily the right word, but where have you seen in these years that maybe you may have heard or actually witnessed someone that, you know, years ago had went through the recovery programs, support prevention programs or whatnot, and you've seen them grow and excelled. And it's like, oh my God, you know, that big turnaround. Where have you seen that in these years?
That's a great question. So one of the things I think is important just for your audience to hear, right, is that I definitely want to encourage men who are listening and watching this to consider becoming involved with your local domestic violence and sexual assault center. There is a place there for you. Even if you don't want to become a victim advocate like me, you can be a donor, you can serve on the board of directors. You have tremendous gifts that you can bring to that organization, right? You can actively, publicly support victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Mm-hmm. The other thing you can do is, if you're a survivor yourself, you share your story, you know. Mm-hmm. If you grew up witnessing and experiencing domestic violence, or if you're a survivor of sexual abuse, mm-hmm. share your story, right? It's important. It's so important for boys and men to hear that, because it gives them permission to come forward and share their story or to get help, mm-hmm. right? And then I think ultimately being witness to that transformation, right? And seeing, you know, I think the hardest part was, this is not the most uplifting thing, but most families, most women and children who come to shelter usually go back to the abusive partner. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some of those women and some of those children end up being killed, right? Like there are real serious consequences with this issue. There are women and children dying. There are men who are dying as a result of domestic violence. And so I think that's the kind of, this is a serious issue that requires a serious response, right? And I think, but I've also witnessed that just profound changes. There's countless children who are now adults that I probably worked with.
Yeah.
Who have gone on to, you know, a lot of times I wouldn't see or hear from them when they left the shelter, which was really always difficult for me, right? The unknown, like, one, there was partly there was an unknown of what their future would hold. But that if I could be that person that for that time, even if it was one day, even if they were in that shelter one day and I got to spend a little bit of time with that kid, that would be the moment that would be transformative and would inform their future, right? Because for me, it just was one man that for me, when I was a teenage boy, that it was Cisco Garcia here at SAFE that like was that transformative man that came into my life at that particular moment and set me along this journey, right? Wow. How, and so because I had Cisco in my life, I was there and I knew that I wanted to be Cisco Garcia for that boy or girl that was coming into the shelter. I wanted that experience to be transformative just for them, you know, that they would, my hope was that they would go on to live, you know, healthy, nonviolent, productive, loving lives, you know, successful lives. I don't know that that's always true, right? Because we didn't keep track of those families after they left shelter, unless they continued some service with the organization. So most times I didn't know. I just prayed that they were doing well. And to be honest, there are folks who have come back to volunteer and to work, to who have ended up working, who are former clients. So I know of individuals that, you know, that have that experience where they benefited from the service that we provided, or that I provided, or that we as a collective organization provided to them. And so they went on to continue to do the work, right? Like they felt like it was important for them to give back what they had received. So that's why it's so important for folks who have been impacted by this issue to get involved, right? To donate, to volunteer, to support policies and that protect victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence, as well as hold offenders and perpetrators accountable, right? So like all of us, everyone who is watching and listening to this has a role and a responsibility in terms of keeping our community safe, right? So if we witness our, if we witness or we hear violence happening in our neighbor, talk to that man.
Yeah.
Check in with that woman. Talk to those children. Make it, like, call the police if you need to, if it's escalating and you're concerned about their safety. Right. Like if you witness or if you believe that a child is being abused, report, you make a report. So I think those are the simple acts of things that every person who is listening and watching this podcast can do, right? That you can literally save someone's life and ultimately be that change, right? Like be that change for them. Because I think you can, again, you can really, you can just be. And like all of us can change the course of people's lives. I believe that. And I know that from experience. And I think that's really important for boys and men to understand as well, that there is a place for you at these organizations that are in every community here in Texas. And there's a need and there's an opportunity there for you to get involved. And so, because if a man had encouraged me to get involved, I would have been more likely and more quickly have gotten involved than it, because it was women, right? Like, because of this, because of that, I opened the door really wide for other men to work. And now there are countless men working at Safe Alliance here in Austin. So again, one man can make a difference. That's fine. There are now like, the idea of having male advocates in the shelter, not a big deal today, you know, because of that, because of, you know, I hate to toot my own horn, but I think we need to understand that the impact of one, that one person can have has now made it possible for men to volunteer and to work as victim advocates in the shelter throughout that agency, right? There are tons of men, wonderful, amazing guys, who have worked or who work at Safe Alliance here in Austin. And that's true all over the state, right? You know, so I hope that other men will feel inspired to get involved.
Oh, in that, as we're ending, I want you to just tell us a little bit in regards to Texas Men Speak. What are at least 2 points that you can tell the men and young men in regards to being part of that prevention program, whether they're being part of the program itself, but just more so being that advocate if they see that issue. I know you were just talking about, in essence, speaking up if they see that act going on. But what are 2 other points that they could take away from that?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up the Texas Men Speak. So, you know, TASA has a statewide initiative where we invite men from around Texas who are just getting into this work, who are doing work around masculinity, fatherhood, men's health, men's sexual health, et cetera, right? Anything related to manhood. We're trying to create a community of support for those guys, right? Because again, I didn't have it when I came into this work. I got that work, I got that support and that encouragement primarily from women, especially from women of color. Right. That really informed my thinking in terms of creating the Texas Men Speak. So we have a monthly virtual gathering for men who are interested in doing the work with each other. right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, every fourth Friday of the month, or the last Friday, I think it's the last Friday of the month, sorry. Mm-hmm. The last Friday of the month, where men from around the state get together through Zoom and just have conversations about different aspects of masculinity and violence prevention, mm-hmm. And sexual violence prevention, et cetera, right? So, you know, this last month, we had a whole conversation about music and masculinity, mm-hmm. right? So we're exploring all of these different topics related to manhood and masculinity.
Yeah.
But more importantly, we're creating a community of support, encouragement, right? For men who want to do the work or who are doing the work, whether they're doing the work professionally or as volunteers. Like, we want to create just a community of men, you know, just like this podcast, that support, encourage men to talk about different aspects of masculinity, what it means, yeah, to be a man, and how men can support, you know, girls and women in their lives and other, mm-hmm. men, right? And so,
yeah,
that's what we're doing. And so I invite anyone who's interested in joining us here in Texas to reach out to me. You can email me at texasmenspeak@tasa.org for more information, or to join our e-list so that you get information about the upcoming meeting. So we meet monthly for an hour, and we just have really honest conversations, and it really is a really unique space. And I'm really honored to be able to, you know, facilitate and moderate this project. And so we're looking to hopefully in the next year be able to meet in person around the state. And so hopefully we'll be able to gather men in person as well as virtually. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to participate through Zoom with the men who are meeting in person. And so that's our hope, is that we can begin to, you know, after we get past COVID and it's safe for, yeah, everyone to participate in person, that we can have these conversations and build more community and organize men locally. And that's really our intention, is we want to see more boys and men involved with their local race crisis center.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Emiliano. Thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been an honor, man.
Oh, great deal, man. It was, I know when I had engaged with you on that Texas Men Speak event, was maybe about 2 months ago, you know, it was cool to, of course, be in the presence of other men speaking about masculinity, because it is it's the necessary conversation for today, but not just for today, but for tomorrow, meaning we don't need to stop it at all. Yeah. Because just as TASA and Texas Men Speak specifically are looking to engage the next generation, so that we're in an effort to combat the issues that we deal with as men. And, you know, in regards specifically to assault, you know, that aggressiveness that we don't know how to manage at all, which, you know, fortunately leads to those results. Yeah. But, you know, in a nutshell, when it comes to the assault, you know, unfortunately, men are normally, for the most part, going to be the perpetrators. That's the unfortunate case. And from a numbers perspective, whatever it is today, I would love to see men being engaged in themselves to make that number go down in regards to being the perpetrator. I want to see that turned around. Because I don't know that, I mean, I'm not in the world of statistics or not, but every time I look at any kind of number regarding whatever situation it is,
it's heartbreaking.
I don't see a action, yeah, that says, okay, we need these many people to be engaged to start, yeah, turning that number.
Yeah, you don't see that number. And like I said, we all, for folks who are tuning in to your podcast, the Mandated Podcast, I think you have that power. One person can make a, mm-hmm, difference, right? You can have that conversation with your brother, your coworker, your classmate, the brother that you're praying with, you know, the men in your worship group, et cetera, right? Yeah. Like, there's, you know, like, just have that conversation. Mm-hmm. More importantly, just be a model of what, mm-hmm, what, healthy manhood looks like, of healthy nonviolent manhood, healthy fatherhood, healthy marriages look like, right? Mm-hmm. I really believe, and I know that I don't have to see anything. I just have to, like, the way that I practiced that, my relationship, the way that I father my son, that people are watching. My son is watching me, right? I'm very aware of that.
That is.
You know, I'm very aware of that because he will call me out when I say or do the wrong thing, right? So that's what I want, is I want to create, like, I want him to have the courage and the conviction to stand up for what he believes, right? When he sees that something, when he sees that someone is in pain or someone is hurting, he steps in and he intervenes, that he helps that person, or that he does what he can to protect them from harm, right? So, and he is doing that, right? Like, I've seen him practice those things. Now, I'd love to believe that he learned that from me, right? But he's also learned that from other men. Right? From the other men in his life, from his grandfather, from his uncle, from his, you know, from his mother. Like, he learns those things also from the girls and women in his life. So, but I think men in particular have had a, like, we just need to be conscious and aware of the power that we have and the privilege, and we have to use that for good, right? It's just like, it's silly to say, but, you know, I think we can really, we can cause a tremendous amount of harm, as you've acknowledged, right? Or we can create a lot of good and a lot of change, and really be good and do good. And I really, I want to live in the world of being and doing good. You know what I mean? Right? Like, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to be. Now, am I always good? Am I always great? Do I always do the right thing? No. I make mistakes. I've made plenty of mistakes in my relationships to my partner, and with my son, and with my coworkers, like with my family members and friends.
Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
But it's my willingness to acknowledge those that have made mistakes, and my willingness to learn and to be different, to do different. And that's why it's important just to hold ourselves accountable and to hold each other accountable. And that's a big part of Texas Men Speak, is to be able to have a community of men who will challenge you, will hold you accountable, will encourage you and support you, and help you be successful, right? In whatever, however you practice your, like, whatever you do. So you don't have to be engaged in this work. You just need to be a guy that's kind of curious and wants to do the right thing, and maybe wants to heal, wants to contribute, wants to get involved, you know. Join us, you know, like, join me, reach out to me. I'm, you know, like, you know, I think it's important for men to be mentors to each other and coaches, you know, like, to, for us to serve as coaches, in all kinds of regards, professionally, athletic, etc., right? Like, it's important for us just to support each other and encourage each other, especially when we, like you said, are doing the right thing, right? You're not going to see the statistics for guys who are, you know, healthy relationships, who are, you know, educators and healthcare workers and, you know, loving parents and helping their neighbor and taking care of their elderly parents, et cetera, right? Like, we're not going to see and hear about those things in the news. So that's why your podcast is so important, for us to just put a spotlight on these wonderful, positive attributes that we have as men, or the contributions that we can make to our communities, right? And that's what I'm trying to do, man. I see my son doing that, and so it gives me a lot of hope for the future. And I see the impact that we're making, but it's going to take a long time, and I believe that we will see an end to domestic and sexual violence, if not in my lifetime, in my son's lifetime. I believe that, man. I believe that.
We definitely need to end with that positive note right there, that there will be an end to domestic and all violence in that manner. So that's awesome, man. Thank you very much, Emiliano, for your time and the insight into sexual assault and what we can do as men to though, as you said, we can't necessarily see the numbers of it being decreased because of involvement, but encouraging men and young men to get involved with the issue and start looking at themselves internally on what they can do to not be that person. And, you know, unfortunately, we've seen role models that have been that person, and we ended up kind of taking on that. But we, through advocacy, through information, through support such as Cisco for yourself, and that one man has the opportunity to change this world. So Emiliano, thank you very much, brother, for being with us today.
Thank you, man. It was a pleasure.
Man. It has been great.